Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Australia in the next decade. We're very grateful to our two speakers. Kelly O'Dwyer's come up from Melbourne and Stephen Jones from Wollongong. So I'll introduce our speakers in the order in which they're speaking. We'll lead off with Kelly O'Dwyer. She is a graduate in arts and law. She worked for Freehills, and then she worked for Peter Costello on his staff and ended up at the National Australia Bank and became the member for Higgins in the by-election in December 2009, shortly after the change of leadership from Malcolm Turnbull to Tony Abbott. Stephen Jones also is a graduate in arts and law. He spent time as a youth worker and then as a lawyer, as a trade union official, and since 2010 he has been the member for Throsby. We're very grateful at this election time that our speakers have been able to find the time to come along and talk tonight on the important topic, Australia in the next decade, a Gen X point of view. Kelly O'Dwyer and Stephen Jones, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and thank you also to Anne and the Sydney Institute for the very kind invitation to come and speak with you this evening. I'm also delighted to be joined by my colleague across the aisle, Stephen Jones, who I've been on a number of different committees with in the previous Parliament. Looking into the crystal ball is always a pretty dangerous thing to do, and even more so for a young politician. Yet, in many ways, the next decade is precisely what this next election is all about, not the unaccountable never-never, nor just the next 3 years. The next decade will see no shortage of hot topics. Security policy will be critical, especially given recent underinvestment and potential for regional instability. The very structure of our federation will come under pressure as vertical fiscal imbalance continues to widen. Globalisation and changing demographics will raise interesting questions for cultural policy. Environmental stewardship will remain a concern, particularly against a backdrop of ever-expanding global population. The implementation of the National Disability Insurance Scheme will present challenges, both known and unforeseen. And the political class will need to confront the process of managing reform. However, this evening I want to focus on the most important issue for the next decade, the need to look increasingly to ourselves rather than to government, and the need to emphasise resilience, aspiration, self-reliance and respect. Let me be clear at the outset, this is not a cuts, cuts, cuts agenda, but an agenda which puts an emphasis on individuals, families and business to look first to themselves rather than to government to meet the challenges ahead. Over the next decade, we are likely to see four key factors converge. First, a structurally challenged budget on top of an unprecedented national debt and unfunded superannuation liabilities. It's hard to quantify the structural deficit from opposition, but it is clearly substantial. First, Labor has already accrued the five biggest deficits in Australian history, totalling $192 billion, with a $3 billion per week run rate deterioration going into the campaign. Second, the government has done this in the midst of a terms of trade and resources boom. Third, the government has committed to very significant, largely unfunded, new growth expenditures beyond the forward estimates. Second of these four key convergent factors, an ageing population. The baby boomers are beginning to retire and life expectancies are increasing. Consider these estimates from the 2010 Intergenerational Report. In the 1970s, there were 7.5 people of working age to support every person aged 65 and older. In 2010, there were 5 people. This is set to fall to 3.9 people by 2020 and 3.2 by 2030. Combined with increased utilisation of health services, it's clear that health and aged care costs are set to rise materially. This will exacerbate the budget challenge ahead. Third of the convergent factors, ongoing rapid technological and social change. Australia should embrace the opportunities new technologies present, but we should not be blind to the challenges. For instance, ensuring older generations are not left socially isolated, and being alive to the potential opportunities and threats for core Australian industries such as education, manufacturing, and retail. Fourth of the factors, an even more interconnected world and the continuing rise of emerging markets in the Asian region. Much of Australia's prosperity can be attributed to our open trade relationships with the developed and developing world. While globalisation can widen our choices, it can also constrain them. This is not always a bad thing. To remain competitive in the war for talent and capital, we must minimise, not raise, corporate and personal income taxes. In addition, globalisation presents potential free rider problems. The middle class in Asia is set to rise exponentially from 500 million people today to around 3.2 million people in 2030. This presents an enormous opportunity. Of course, a rising Asia doesn't create more consumers for our products. It also creates more competitors for our businesses. We must be alive to those businesses having vastly different cost structures to our own. Collectively, these four factors will place pressure on both our economy and our society. For instance, one of the great achievements of Australian society has been our capacity to largely eliminate social fault lines, notwithstanding the recent attempts to foster class, race, and gender wars over the last couple of years. Over the next decade, I expect the greatest potential stresses to be along generational lines, with many in younger generations faced with housing affordability and unemployment challenges, querying why they are supporting older generations who, in their minds at least, faced lower housing costs, did not make appropriate ongoing investments in infrastructure and security, and did not provide for the cost of their care during their working years. This judgment may well be unfair, but there is clear potential for it to emerge, particularly given the reckless spending and borrowing of recent years. At the same time, there is a risk that older generations increasingly feel left behind by technological and social change, and they might be left behind economically, given increased life expectancies and the rising cost of living. In this context, Generation X has a pivotal role to play. We must rise to the occasion and be self-sufficient, rather than draw down on the future. Inevitably, we will need to provide a bridge between our parents' generation and emerging social developments and reciprocate the care that they delivered to us when we were young in their old age. Equally, we must foster a value system amongst younger generations that equips them to deal with the challenges ahead. One of the first things Generation X must do is recognise that government cannot and should not seek to solve every problem. As a Liberal, it won't surprise that I think government's role should be limited. But this is not simply a philosophical perspective, it is also a pragmatic one. First, government is structurally limited. Blurred lines of accountability between the Commonwealth and states undermine both levels' capacity to deliver efficient services. The Coalition's promised white paper on the Federation could not come soon enough. Second, as the population continues to grow, government becomes more and more removed from the people. Those on the front line of service delivery remain close to the community, but accountable to an increasingly distant central bureaucracy. The Coalition's commitment to give greater autonomy to the boards of organisations such as hospitals and schools will be critical. Third, as I have already pointed out, there are going to be significant limitations on funding for government activities, with a budget that is already in structural deficit, a population that is ageing, and practical limitations on Australia remaining competitive if we increase taxes. Fourth, in an interconnected world, the practical limitations on government solving every problem will be limited. Think issues like cyberbullying and the online proliferation of adult content. Yes, government has a role across a whole range of areas. A compassionate society demands we step in to assist those who genuinely need support. An opportunity society requires investment in quality public education. A functioning society requires ongoing investment in productivity-enhancing public infrastructure. A secure society requires significant investment in national security. My concern is that our culture has developed to expect a government to solve every problem. Let's take increasing productivity as a case study. What is the appropriate role for government in delivering productivity improvements over the next decade? Remember, while some of the benefits of productivity improvements are captured by the public, many are private. Clearly, government needs to drive productivity growth in its own operations. Amongst other things, that means eliminating duplication and confused lines of accountability in government and driving a culture of excellence and productivity growth throughout the entire public service. But the discourse around productivity tends to surround private sector productivity. In this context, government needs to shift its focus further along the spectrum from funding and regulatory interventions to getting the settings for productivity growth right. We need to create an environment where it is worthwhile for business and not-for-profits to invest in productivity-enhancing initiatives, like further education and training for their staff, new capital projects, or new innovations. That requires innovations and initiatives like minimising corporate taxes and restoring predictability in public policy. We need to recognise that an innovation culture is at least as much about restoring the entrepreneurial spirit and genuine reward for effort as it is about public funding for science and R&D. And we need to ensure that government doesn't strangle the private sector, for instance, by addressing over-regulation. The Coalition has committed to cutting $1 billion a year in red and green tape. Clearly, there is a role for government in regulation and equally a role for government in funding measures which support productivity growth. I have mentioned education, but equally this applies to infrastructure. Importantly, the Coalition's policies on the NBN, the East-West Link in Melbourne and WestConnex in Sydney all recognise that a mix of public and private funding is appropriate. But ultimately, the bulk of productivity growth over the next decade must be delivered by individual businesses and not-for-profit organisations performing better. Government's most valuable contribution will be to reduce the obstacles in their way. Managing the necessary reduction in emphasis on government and the emerging intergenerational fault lines requires four core Australian characteristics to be restored to their rightful place: resilience, aspiration, self-reliance and respect. First, resilience. Throughout Australian society, we must rediscover the patience, perspective and resilience to withstand difficult times, criticism and failure, and of course to cope with change. Politicians must be prepared to say no to poorly thought through new regulation or government handout and risk negative short-term headlines. We must be prepared to weather the storm on difficult reforms. Business must be prepared to adjust and manage through difficult times on their own. Investors must be prepared to wear short-term price hits and back long-term vision. Employees must expect and be ready to embrace new work practices and new workplaces as challenges and opportunities evolve. Schools must be prepared to fail our children so that they learn to come back again and do better. And we must steel those same children for the threats of cyberbullying and our youth for the inevitable day when a mistake recorded forever in the cloud comes back to bite them. We have it in ourselves to rediscover resilience. Time and again, our communities demonstrate it in the face of natural disaster. Indeed, those experiences highlight not only that each individual must build resilience, but also that we need to invest in the relationships which reinforce that resilience. Quite simply, families, friends and communities can provide emotional reassurance and support that government simply cannot. To a large extent, aspiration relies on resilience. After all, no one achieves without hard work and without taking risks. But there is another sense in which it relies on resilience, the need for society to accept difference and not be afraid of it. We should celebrate successful people, including those in business, not demonise them. We should encourage our brightest children to learn more, not seek to hobble them in a misguided fear that their classmates will be discouraged. We should be prepared to be different. Critically, aspiration must be coupled with a strong understanding of self-reliance. We need individuals, families, and communities to want the best for themselves and for their community. That's what drives society forward. But equally, we must recognise that individual, family, and community action should deliver on that aspiration, not government. Self-reliance reduces the call on the Australian budget, but more importantly, offers important social benefits through the dignity of supporting oneself and one's family. If aspiration finds its expression primarily in a productivity agenda, self-reliance finds its expression primarily in a participation agenda. That is, participating in the economy and society to stand on one's own two feet and to return to the economy and society at least what one has taken out of it. In the context of the intergenerational divide, it translates to recognising that each generation should at least provide for itself. Finally, I want to spend a moment talking about fostering respect for one another. Regrettably, I think mutual respect has deteriorated in recent years. Increased online communication without the benefit of visual and facial cues probably hasn't helped. And I'm the first to raise my hand to say that my colleagues and I need to do better as leaders and raise the standard in national debate. But frankly, we all need to do better. Respect just isn't about person-to-person conduct. It's about a deep understanding of different people's contributions and points of view. Along with economic growth, I think that this will be one of the key solutions to the potential intergenerational fault lines in the decades ahead. Just as economic growth and increased understanding underpin the great Australian success in managing other potential fault lines such as race, class, and religion. Over the next decade, we will need to build an increased understanding of and respect for the contribution that older generations have made to Australia. Equally, we will need to build an increasing understanding amongst older Australians about the challenges and pressures facing their grandchildren and great-grandchildren and respect for their approach to addressing them. Generation X is the pivot generation that will bridge this divide. The challenge is there for us. Like so many of the other areas that I've discussed tonight, I'm very optimistic that we can deliver.
Thank you. So the Governor, Stephen Jones. Thanks.
Thanks, Gerard, and ladies and gentlemen, great to be with you this evening. Great to be joining you once again, Kelly O'Dwyer, for an exchange of ideas and thoughts. I'll see if I can meet the challenge of raising the standard of debate. At the turn of the last century, a new nation was born. It was crafted in the Antipodes from the colonies of Britain. It was as inspired by the new democracy in North America as it was loyal to its imperial sovereign. In the 112 years since, we've built one of the most successful, peaceful, and wealthiest nations on earth, not without fault or cost. For too long, we denied the rights of Aboriginal people. We've not always been good custodians of the land. We persisted with the notion of white Australia long after we knew that it was wrong. But today, we are a peaceful, wealthy, resilient, and energetic nation, with every reason to be optimistic about our future. As we look around the world, we know that our future is not guaranteed. Our future will be forged in the suburbs and the cities, in the regions and in the parliaments of our nation. It will be imagined and contested by our generation of leaders who offer themselves up to be voted in to the next parliament. I enter this election confident of where our best future lies. I believe that our future prosperity and security lies within the Asia-Pacific region. We have it within our grasp to build an economic powerhouse, an open trading nation that is truly, truly engaged with the nations of the Asia-Pacific. A prosperous, stable and outward-looking democracy, reconciled to its Aboriginal people, confident as a new republic but proud of its British ancestry. A country that is as good at tackling inequality as it is at creating wealth. A country that can foster a new generation of entrepreneurs who are as conscious of their obligation to community and the environment as they are of their obligation to their shareholders. A country that sees its social and cultural and religious diversity not as a threat, but as an essential part of its national identity. This future can be built by leaders who are economically literate, socially progressive, and engaged with the region, entrepreneurial by instinct, and committed to prosperity with equality. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that Australia needs the Australian Labor Party to be a part of building this future. And the Australian Labor Party needs leaders who can make this future happen. A short introduction to myself. I was elected to Parliament in 2010. This followed a long career as a community worker, a lawyer and a union official. In many ways, I have the archetypal background of a Labor MP. I grew up in a large Catholic family in the industrial heartland of Wollongong. I did not follow the same path as many of those who came before me into the steelworks or the mines of the Illawarra. There are a few reasons for this. The year I left school, the steel industry and mines were plunged into recession. Thousands of jobs were lost. The capacity to take up a trade of your choosing that had been the path of my friends and relatives disappeared. Luckily, I was a good student, and my parents had always impressed upon us the importance of education and hard work as the path to success. I finished school and worked in as many casual jobs as I could find before travelling around the country and then going to university. My political conviction was born of this early experience. I saw firsthand the devastation caused by mass unemployment. And it's not just the poverty wrought by loss of livelihood, but the loss of hope, of optimism, and the waste of human potential. I determined that I wanted to make a difference, even though I didn't know at the time exactly how that was going to be. I have been very lucky ever since to find work that has been an expression of my personal values. I believe this will typically be a future of mine and other generations to come. When I joined the Labor Party, it was because I believed the community organisations needed to work with and within political parties to pursue their objectives. I had no idea at the time that I joined that I'd end up becoming a member of the Australian Parliament. Ladies and gentlemen, it's customary to recite the achievements of a party, whether it's the Liberal Party or my party, as a prelude to the exploration of the new frontiers, for good reason. Political movements draw strength and inspiration and identity from their past and purpose from the challenges of the future. For over 100 years, Labor's contribution to Australia has been to build a prosperous but fairer nation by providing employees with rights at work, through the creation of a social safety net, by providing access to health and education, and by building the economic infrastructure that the private sector could not or would not build. Labor legislated against discrimination and gave land rights to the first Australians and legislated to protect our environments. These were powerful new ideas producing hard-won reforms, the result of tough political battles. Often the first battleground was within the party itself. But I make this point, and it's an important point. Once Labor adopted a position around an idea, it gave that idea the chance to enter the mainstream of political discussion. Only a major political party can achieve this, and the reason is simple. Government in Australia is the battle between the major parties for the middle ground. But unlike the ocean's tides, once the shift in the middle ground has occurred, we never return to the same place. When Labor adopted the idea of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, as Kelly has mentioned, we argued the case and succeeded in convincing not only the nation, but even our political opponents, that this must happen. Other examples abound. We can cite Medicare, native title, an apology, industrial awards, even paid parental leave, which once was described by Tony Abbott as occurring over his dead body. It's now firmly an idea within the political mainstream. The same can be said of our economic reforms, and I take this opportunity to pay great tribute to the work of the Hawke and Keating governments, opening up our financial markets, reforming trade and tariffs, establishing occupational superannuation, and even small things like share market reforms and franking dividends, which have had a massive impact on ordinary Australians investing in the share market. Labor argued the case to bring these ideas into the mainstream. And once the middle ground has been established, the reforms endure and the bitter political battles proceeded, fade from memory. Labor's enduring contribution to Australia's social and economic fabric has been to shift the marker of the middle ground through landmark reforms which have gone on to define our nation. Can I turn to the new frontiers for progressive politics? Others might stand here and talk about things like the fight for equality, a republic. Climate change will feature strongly, I know, and marriage equality is another. I won't labour that issue. I believe the debate's actually been won within the community. It's just taking a while for some of Kelly's and my political colleagues to catch up on the matter. I want to focus on our role in the region. Australia's future prosperity and security lies within our region. Our economic, cultural and security will be built on the enduring and reciprocal relationships which focus on long-term and mutual benefits, not short-term opportunism. No country, in my mind, is more important than Indonesia and our long-term relationships with a country which is one of our nearest neighbours. These relationships are not a foregone conclusion. We need only look at debates around foreign investment and our engagement with Asia to see where the threats lie. I've been amused, although I support the notion of a land register, a register to see how much of our land is being owned by overseas nationals. I think it would be equally interesting to see a register of how much property is owned by Australians in other nations to balance the debate. Our generation of leaders still has work to do to shift the common sense on these issues. To remain an open trading nation, we have to convince sometimes reluctant nation that there is more to be gained than lost from an engagement, a deep engagement, with the Asia-Pacific region and the rest of the world. We need to deepen the understanding of the importance of our relationship with these nations. We need to do more to assist the economic and social transitions that are occurring, particularly in regions like mine, which have been beset by the impact of a very high Australian dollar and strong competition from the Asia-Pacific region on its traditional manufacturing base. On this last point, the fight for equality is the handmaiden of economics and business. I'll give you an example. A worker who loses his or her job because their employer can't compete with low-priced imports is very little interested in Adam Smith's theory of competitive advantage. Without a job, they benefit little from the cheaper consumer goods on offer. They become a willing ear for simple slogans, and there are many on offer in this election. And we should not think, I should say, that the rhetoric that is delivered from one policy silo does not spill over to other areas. It does, and the debate around immigration is a case in point. The second issue I wish to talk about is our relationship with small business. It can and should transcend the transactional, campaign-driven exchange of request and policy concession. Labor was born of the aspiration of working people. But our party needs to recognise that the way work is done has changed. In increasing numbers, we are now working in small business or running them. Labor has to extend its gaze to this new world of work and apply our traditional values of equality and fairness to the needs and aspirations of this world. I believe we have much to offer. For a party formed on the idea of the dignity of work, it should be common sense that a small business is not just a means of making a living and generating wealth, it's also an expression of aspiration by the individuals involved in setting it up. For a party formed on the idea that individuals who bargain collectively can overcome the imbalance of power between labour and capital, it should be common sense that the same imbalance exists between the small and large businesses, particularly when they contract with each other. For a party that is committed to ensuring the tax burden is distributed so that those with more pay proportionately more than those with little, it should come as common sense to see that our tax system should be both efficient and fair to small business. And for a party that is committed to building and providing the infrastructure and service that the private sector can't or won't provide, we should be natural partners of small business that rely on our roads, our rail, our communication systems, and the graduates of our schools, TAFEs, and universities. We are building the infrastructure of the future. The NBN is an example, delivering fibre optic cable to over 93% of Australian homes and businesses. But with this project, we are also building equality. We're building equality between cities and regions, equality between high and low income families, equality of access to markets between big businesses and small businesses. That's why it is a Labor project and why it took a Labor government to conceive of it and to build it. Small businesses and entrepreneurial enterprises will thrive and prosper through fibre optic connectivity to the ideas and the markets of Asia Pacific and the rest of the world. With the national broadband network, the next big thing in this country will be lots of little things. Small enterprises founded on big dreams and able to reach out to the world and beyond. The third and final point I want to make is about progressive entrepreneurs. I believe that it's folly to assume that those who work in business are unyielding in support of one side of politics or another. I know of many successful entrepreneurs who firmly believe in generating social wealth, yet who are appalled by the intellectual paucity of Australia's political debate. They believe in equality, in Australia as a republic, in the fair treatment of asylum seekers, and they believe in climate change in a sensible market-based solution for the addressing of that issue. They believe in justice for the first Australians. They do not believe that their success rests on the exploitation of those beneath them. They are frustrated that that most important political debate that we have to have around productivity is narrowed to a very small focus on industrial relations. They believe in equality and fairness and a better Australia. Their politics embraces the future, not the past. I'd argue that they don't have a natural place in any one particular party, not the Liberal Party, not the Labor Party. Over the next 10 years, Labor must and will extend its gaze to embrace the entrepreneurial innovator and the progressive thinker, the small business person, and those that we traditionally rely on to generate and to shift the middle ground in Australian politics so that we can take on the challenges of our future. These are the people that I'd like to seek to give a voice to in the Australian Parliament. These are the people that I want to work with to ensure that we realise that great optimistic future that I outlined at the outset. Thank you for the time this evening.
Just go over there. Just stay there. And Kelly, we'll get you to come up here. Many thanks to Kelly O'Dwyer and Stephen Jones for both informative talks and for keeping to the time. So we've got to the top of the hour to do questions and discussion. I should also say thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this great facility this evening. And so we come to question and discussion. Kelly, if you come around this way, and then I'll ask you questions. No, you stay here, because I'm going to disappear, okay? to make a lot of people happy. You're both some of the more articulate, able younger parliamentarians, Gen X, but as you are well aware, there's Gen Y, and increasingly among, particularly in the Illawarra, less in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, but a growing level of unemployment among younger Australians who seem to be having great difficulty of getting employment. I know there are no easy solutions, but if you're looking 10 years out, how would you be looking at trying to reduce the level of unemployment among young Australians? Now, you can take it in order anywhere you like, and then...
Can I start by saying that we would not... You don't start by kidding a young person who is at school today that they can drop out of school early, not complete their high school education, and that they are going to be able to have the same job that their father or mother had and enjoy the same sorts of income and wealth and opportunity in life that perhaps their father or mother had. Those jobs are no longer there and they're not coming back. So the best thing that we can do to ensure that we deal with long-term youth unemployment and long-term unemployment is ensure that our kids complete and get a high-quality education. Not every kid who finishes Year 12 is going to go on to university. Some of them will want to get a trade or a traineeship. So embedding the vocational education and training system within our school system through initiatives like the trade training centres is a great part of that, ensuring that a kid can get a start in an apprenticeship while they're still at school. There's also the issue of long-term unemployment, and there are some suburbs within my electorate. By design, I say regretfully, because when you have conclaves of housing commission suburbs and you can see a household where there's been three generations of people who've never had a job, and that a young person can walk outside that door and walk down the street and not know anybody who's ever had a job, it's not just the supply of jobs that is the issue. It's the long-term lack of a social network and some of the behavioural issues as well as the skills issues that need to be dealt with. So expensive interventions, intensive interventions need to be put in place to deal with that cohort of long-term unemployed people. It costs money, but it costs a lot more money if we don't address those sorts of issues. Finally, I'd say that we need to, and I think this is something that you and I agree on, Kelly, we need to be able to diversify our economic base to ensure that regions like my own don't have a future which is as reliant as it has been on the past on one or two industries. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question, Jared. First, I'd like to point out that in Higgins, actually, I do have quite a number of Housing Commission flats, not only in Prahran but also in Ashburton. And there are, as Stephen has pointed out, people who have not seen an example of somebody who in their adult life has been employed. This is something that seriously concerns me as well. But I suppose we probably have somewhat similar of an idea as to how you address or give some of the tools to people to be able to get a job, and education and apprenticeship training, allowing people to have those sorts of opportunities is probably where we would agree. But where we would differ is that we also need to create a culture where people need to get a job and where it is valued to go out and get a job. And that starts with their very first job. And what really concerns me, and particularly when I look around my area, I'm part of the retail mecca of the country in the seat of Higgins, with High Street, Armidale, Chapel Street, and also the big shopping centres of Chadstone. People now who first got their very first job in retail and also in hospitality are no longer having those opportunities, because it is too hard now for people to employ young people in that very first job. There are less jobs available in those sectors. And we were talking about small business people just before. I think a lot of the small business people of today are actually the working poor. They're the people who are working the hours that other people either aren't prepared to work or that they can't afford them to work. So giving people the very first opportunity to have a job will give them the next best opportunity to then get their next job. I also think we need to grow the economic pie. We need to make it easier for business to set up and to succeed in this country. One of the ways that we can do that is to try and get rid of as much unnecessary regulation and red tape that currently exists as we speak today. The current government has introduced more than 21,000 new regulations and got rid of less than 104 of those regulations. This has a significant impost on business, and it means that it has a constraining impact on their ability to invest in their business, to grow their business, and to then employ more people, and that includes young people as well. So we need to get out of the way of business to allow them to get on with growing their business, to have the confidence to employ people, particularly young people.
Okay, so we question Paul.
Should we stand?
Just a minute. Long as you don't stand in front of the camera.
Yep. A question that both the speakers might address, and they both spoke very well across their topics, was the issue of blurred lines between Commonwealth and states and the vertical fiscal imbalance. A big issue for our country, and I remember Bob Hawke in an ABC lecture before he went to Parliament, I believe, talking about the fact that we had one too many layers in government. I don't think he ever made that speech again. There were too many vested interests in the political system to give it any oxygen. But later on, there was a combined effort between the regime in Canberra at the time and in Sydney to start talking about selective removal of one of the governments from one or other of the policy areas. Can we hear what Gen X think about that big structural issue and what either of you might like to see a government doing in the next 3 years about
it? Sure. If you were designing the Australian Federation today, you'd do it differently. There is no doubt about that. And the second observation I would make is that across the political spectrum, certainly in the last 15 to 20 years when I've been observing national politics closely, what you'll see is the Commonwealth being seen as the government of last resort. And by that I mean that when people find frustrations with their education system, with their transport, with their communication system, with their health system, they go to the Commonwealth and say, we want the Commonwealth to do something about this. Accelerated by vertical fiscal imbalance, which Kelly touched upon, I don't expect that over the next 10 years, and let's just keep it safe, we're going to see any successful constitutional rewrite on this issue. So the best tools that are available to us are those that have been established through the COAG process to try and get some level of coordination and cooperation. And we have seen examples where the states have receded from territories that the Commonwealth have not got constitutional competence in but have the capacity to operate in. I'd like to see more of that sort of approach. We're not going to get it. We're not going to achieve it if recent history is any evidence by the use of a foghorn, more by use of the telephone, I'd suggest.
Well, I respectfully disagree with you, Stephen, on that, because I'm far more optimistic about our ability to tackle what I think is a very, very big and major structural problem for our country. I do believe in our federation. I'm a great federalist, but I do think that we have definitely gone down the wrong path with the duplication that we are seeing and the complete confusion in who is accountable for what. And I think that the federal white paper that we will have on state and federal responsibilities is going to be a very core component of working out who should be responsible, and at the same time having a paper that looks at who is going to collect what tax and who's going to get the benefit of those taxes will also play a role in that. I don't think you can do one without the other. I certainly accept that we in the coalition bear some measure of responsibility in how this has progressed, in that I believe during our previous time in government, we were a very successful government, and there were lots of very unsuccessful state Labor governments, and there was a huge competency creep. And that meant that people, including business, came to the Commonwealth and said, we want you to intervene in areas where historically the Commonwealth had not been involved. Now, we need to take stock of that because we are now in a situation where, for instance, in health, you can look at the fact that in 2007 we had three federal health bureaucracies, and we are now more than 16 health bureaucracies that oversee one another, and we don't run federally one hospital. Now, this is madness, and this is something that we actually need to address. The final point I just want to make is that I don't hold out hope that the COAG process is going to fix this problem at all. COAG has become a dumping ground for difficult issues, and it has also become, I think, an excuse for the lowest possible common denominator becoming the national norm. I don't think that that is going to help us lift our productivity. It's not going to help us provide better accountability, and it's not going to help better policy or decision making. So I think we do need to look very seriously at the structure of our federation, and I think that the only party that will do that is the Liberal Party in conjunction with our national colleagues.
Can I just address one issue that came up
just
there?
Just briefly.
It's always easy to point at the number of houses in a street and say there's waste in that. Yeah. Let me give you one example of why one of those federal government health agencies has been a success in exactly what you're talking about. Prior to the establishing of a National Health Professionals Registration Board, there was a different board for doctors and nurses nurses and allied health professionals in every state in the country. We established through the COAG process one, so that you didn't have to get a different ticket to practice as a nurse in New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria. You go to one board, and it simplified the system.
So there's a question here. Yeah.
Yes, my daughter works for Allied Health. I hope you don't mind me sitting down. I've
got not at all.
And that actually happened under the Howard years, because it actually went through when the Rudd government had come in. But it was being looked at when the Howard years were, Howard government was in, because my daughter came home and said, guess what, Mum? It's going to be naturalised. So, and I said, right. And she said, we'll still be able to register in each state.
Okay, it's getting a bit complicated. There's a question about registration, right?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
So you're agreeing with Stephen?
No, it was done through the Howard years before. Stephen said that they did it.
Oh. I don't think I claim property in it. I just said that it's pretty simple to say that there's five and therefore it's complicated and bad. Well, actually, one of those is about reducing the number of state bureaucracies that are regulating an area.
All right, so we go here. Yeah.
I guess what I'm interested in is Kelly, what you were talking about in terms of resilience, like there's that. And my question's actually to you. Does respect how what we're going to do as a nation, like I know you've got answers for the structures and policies, etc., but I think those issues of respect, resilience, aspiration, and I think perhaps the lack of respect, I think the political class perhaps has to bear some fault for that. But I guess what I'm saying is, do you agree with, I'm asking you, Stephen, do you agree with that notion? And if so, if some of those notions that Kelly said, and if so, how do you see that as in the future of us as a nation growing?
Okay, so how are you going to be more respectful to...
I think the question was about both resilience and respect.
Resilience.
I think my life story is a testament to the importance of that. I left school in the middle of the worst recession ever to hit my region. Most of my mates were unemployed. If they left school the year earlier, they wouldn't have been. And yet, we managed to work hard and find our way through those very difficult years and to get ourselves back on our feet. So I don't think any one side of politics has property and resilience. We all believe in it, and I think it's a part of the Australian character that we all celebrate. On the issue of respect, I could not agree more, Diane. That we run the danger in this country of confusing our colloquial informality with a lack of respect, and we should never allow that to happen. The fact that somebody can throw a sandwich at the Prime Minister and that is seen as something that we can all laugh at, frankly, I think that's very, very wrong. I don't care who the Prime Minister is, you respect the office. You respect the office.
Yeah, well, I think that's completely right. But I'm quite happy to also comment on what Stephen talked about as well, if you'd like me to do the reverse. Because I think there are some comments that I would have some agreement on, in that foreign investment is an area that I think has received a lot of national attention recently, and I think not least of which because your current Prime Minister has brought it into prominence in recent times. He started life, or at least political life, in 2007.
Just be brief here because...
Sure. As an economic conservative, but now, of course, he's an economic nationalist. And there were some comments even on the front page of the papers today that were talking about the very direct impact that this discussion around foreign investment is having on investor confidence in this country and our ability to be able to grow our businesses, because we won't be able to attract necessarily global capital. And I think that is very concerning. I think that there is a very important place for foreign investment in this country. It has helped grow our country from its very inception, and I'd be very concerned if we headed down the path where this is something that becomes an issue of contention in this country.
Okay, we've got a question here, then we've got a question here, then we've got a question there. Yes, we've got to be fairly quick. Yeah.
Today's topic's Australia in the next decade. So, both of you probably could just elaborate what will be the one thing substantially different from what we have today. We call ourselves a lucky country.
The one substantial difference that might occur in the next 10 years?
Difference? Well, my whole thesis is that I actually think we're going to be facing a lot of competing pressures, and I think that Generation X is going to be that pivot generation that is going to have to deal with a lot of the legacies of the baby boomer generation and also have to prepare for the next generation. And I think that we have been put in a position that is very challenging, but not one that is not without opportunity as well. And I was trying to argue today that I think that we can face those challenges. I've identified what I think that they might be in a pretty comprehensive way if we actually start addressing those issues today.
Stephen?
The world will become smaller. The internet has changed everything. My daughter, who is now 9, will probably attend a university which is run by a country somewhere else or an organisation somewhere else in the world. She may attend lectures at a regional campus or a capital city campus, but her teachers will be sourced from all around the world. And when she graduates from that university, as I earnestly hope that she does, or maybe she doesn't, she will start work in a job that hasn't yet been invented.
There's a question here.
Roger, Mr. Jones, you've talked about equality, and obviously if people can't earn more for producing more, then no more is produced in terms of incentive. So is incentive at all considered in the ALP at all, or it's not relevant, it's not important at all? No incentive is required.
It's a question about the importance of incentive.
Yeah. Incentive. Yes.
Absolutely, incentive is critical. Incentive comes in all sorts of forms. The stuff that everyone can tangibly relate to is a monetary incentive. But I think it underlies a more important point. Productivity has to improve, and the debate has to improve beyond a narrow focus around industrial relations.
Right, now a lot of people got their hands up, so I'm going to go to Dennis and then Lynn.
My question relates to a recent retiring MP who highlighted that there was 600,000 children in poverty in Australia, and I'd be very interested in terms of the mixed short term, the next 3 years, 6 years, what an income coalition government will do to lift the lot of that 600,000, or if we get a Labor government back, what they would continue.
Question about 600,000 children in poverty.
Sure. Well, I haven't seen that particular study, and I'd be interested to understand what we mean by poverty when we're talking about poverty. But certainly, for those in great need, we have a moral obligation to provide a social safety net. There is no question about that. I talked in my speech about the need to also provide opportunities through education and other investments in vital infrastructure for all children in this country. But I think we need not to confuse the fact that there are some instances where people choose not to take advantage of all of the opportunities that are provided to them. There is only so much that government can do in those circumstances. That's why I talk about the need to actually shift and change the culture of the country, so that there is also a responsibility, not just at a government level, but at a community level and at a parental level, to actually deal with some of these issues that, frankly, often ought to be dealt with in the home in the first instance.
Stephen Hill.
I won't add to the things that I said earlier, sir, about the importance of education for breaking that intergenerational inequality and breaking the cycle of poverty. Obviously, a job is always the best means of dragging a family out of poverty. There is an important role for the social safety net and our welfare system. When you have organisations as diverse as the Business Council of Australia and the Australian Council of Social Security saying our current levels of unemployment benefits are too low and are now starting to act as an inhibitor for people entering the labour market, we know we've got an issue to address.
Lynn?
Politicians are really good at doing things and doing new things, but they're not particularly good at unpicking old stuff, right? And both of you are going to be faced with a lot of hard choices about unpicking old stuff, and that's not going to make you popular. What characteristics of Gen X do you think you're going to bring to achieving what previous generations have failed to achieve?
I believe, Lynn, you're right. It's much, much harder to undo something that's done than it is not to do it in the first place. So I think you're absolutely right. And part of what I was talking about tonight is also to not make some of those decisions that will leave us in an even worse position as we go forward. But also when we look back, we actually look at those priority areas which are going to make a massive difference. What do I think Generation X brings? I think we are, on the whole, pretty optimistic, and I think we are going to need to be pretty optimistic in dealing with some of these challenges. I also think that we can, in our position, see very clearly the pressures that face an older generation and the pressures that face a younger generation as well. And I think because of that, there is a really strong incentive to tackle some of these pretty thorny issues, because it is not only for our parents but also for our children.
Stephen, we're getting close to a conclusion. Stephen?
Yeah. I refer to the comments I made in my address about the importance of shifting the common sense and the middle ground. To do that, you not only need leaders with the courage to stand up and have a long conversation over a long period of time, you need a network of advocacy to change the common sense of a nation. And whether that's about undoing or changing or reforming things that have already been done, or whether that's embarking on new frontiers, you need both of those things.
Now, I've called Ian, so I've got to take Ian as the last question. I know there are more people here, but we just can't handle it all. Ian? Yep.
Question for Kelly. Kelly, on the bringing your purview from 10 years back to the more immediate future, and the assumption that there is a change of government on the weekend, what should the priorities be for the first 100 days?
Well, we'll get both people to comment. We'll get Kelly comment first because she led off. We'll finish up with Stephen. So the question is, if there is a change of government addressed to Kelly, what would the priorities be? And we'll get Stephen to talk about, if there's not a change of government, what would the priorities be? Kelly.
The very first priority is to be able to restore confidence. Confidence is at an all-time low in this country, and to be able to restore confidence, to be able to give people the understanding that we will be a very predictable government that will govern through the normal mechanisms of government, which means that you will consult with people, that you won't make knee-jerk responses, and that you will methodically go through a reform process, I think will be the very beginnings of a long-term plan. In the first 100 days, that is going to be our very core focus, and obviously understanding exactly what is the budget bottom line right now and the size and significance of the structural deficit.
Stephen, the results the other way?
Look, we've got a project part completed. Our project around education reform, our project around rolling out the national broadband network, our project to roll out the national disability insurance scheme. In fact, all of the major reform projects that I outlined in the beginning are part completed, and they need to be completed, and that should be the priority of an incoming Labor government. Or, sorry, a continuing Labor government. Thank you. Continuing Labor government.
Now we're all making sense. Look, many thanks. Look, I know there are more questions here, but we always finish on time, and Kelly Dwyer has to get away for a plane. We're very grateful to Kelly Dwyer for coming up from Melbourne, to Stephen Jones for coming up from Wollongong. People talk about politicians. Sometimes they criticise politicians, but when you see young politicians like our two speakers in action tonight, you realise that we've got very talented people in the Parliament who do treat one another very well, and we've had an informative discussion. There's been a lot of respect, which has been very nice, and people have addressed the issues and in a very forthright and direct manner. So that's been great. I think Anne set this up originally. I think we set it up before the election was called, and now the election has been called. But after the election, whatever the result, independently, we'd like to have Kelly back and Stephen back to
for the
talk.
Unplugged version.
But that's beyond next Saturday. And for tonight, I'd just like to say a great night and many thanks. Well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.